Back when personal computers were taking off in the mid-1980s, Apple Computer aired a now famous ad during the Super Bowl. It was a play off George Orwell's 1984, and in it, the world is gray. From a giant computer screen, a Big Brother-type person spews out propaganda. That is, until a lone woman runs toward the screen and smashes it with a hammer.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
The message was clear. Apple was providing a choice to consumers. But in today's tech circles, there's a growing discussion over whether Apple has now become the man that it warned against so long ago. In a few weeks, Apple will release the iPad. It's a portable touchscreen computer similar to the iPhone or the iPod Touch. And like those products, it will only run on Apple's operating system and only with applications approved by Apple, sold only through Apple's online application store. Farhad Manju is a technology columnist for Slate, and he's with me from KALW in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
First of all, describe how the Apple Application Store works.
Yeah, so for all computer systems, we need to get software to make our computers do more things.
Right.
And for PCs, we're used to get, you know, just buying software from any store or going to the web and downloading stuff. For the iPhone and the iPod Touch and soon the iPad, what you have to do is go to the app store that it's built into the device. And there's a little button. You click it. You choose whatever kind of app you want, and it downloads instantly, and it's on your phone or your iPod Touch, and it runs instantly. So it's very convenient.
And Apple owns the store, and so they get a cut of everything sold.
Yes, they get 30%. So if an independent developer creates a program, they sell it for $1. The developer gets 70 cents. Apple gets 30 cents.
Now, this week, a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation got hold of and then published an Apple corporate document, which the company had kept secret. And it's basically a contract that the developers have to sign before they can even create applications for the iPhone and the iPad. What did the document reveal?
Yeah, first of all, it's pretty remarkable that it's been secret all this time. And one of the reasons it's secret is because there are 100,000 developers who are creating programs for the iPhone, but they all have to sign this document. And one of the provisions on this document says that they can't publicly speak about it.
So what are some of the restrictions?
One of the things that you can't, that Apple has the right to do, is to remove any app from the store at any time for any reason that it determines. It doesn't even have to state a reason. Actually, we've seen this happen many times since the App Store opened, for various reasons, some of which seemed reasonable and many of which seemed completely arbitrary.
Why does Apple make these products so restrictive?
Apple wants to make sure that everything on the iPhone and the iPad is easy to use, and also that it should sort of live up in a certain sense to the Apple brand.
Well, what is the tech community saying in terms of the implications of all of this? I mean, given that Apple is the gatekeeper, what does this mean for consumers, especially in the future?
So it sets up, as I see it, a dangerous precedent, because we're used to this sense in computing, in the computer industry, that things are becoming freer all the time. But there's this fear now that Apple and devices like the iPad might come to restrict computing again. And in a general sense, it kind of places limits on what consumers can do and what developers can do. And, you know, people in the computer industry see this as dangerous for innovation and kind of dangerous in general for the industry.
That's Farhad Manju. He's a technology columnist for Slate.com. Farhad, thanks so much for joining me.
Great. Good to be here.
For filmmakers, musicians, and digitally creative people, Austin, Texas is the place to be this week. It's the site of the annual South by Southwest Festival, where new movies are screened, new artists are showcased, and new applications are launched. It is also where Leanne Hansen is this weekend, and she joins us from member station KUT in Austin to tell us about it. Hey there, Leanne.
Hey there, Audie.
So what's going on?
Oh, it's amazing. The interactive component of the festival got underway Friday, and I'll tell you, this place is crawling with young people, old people, tattooed people. I've even spotted a few guys wearing kilts. The place is wired. I mean, there are lounges in the convention center where you can go have yourself a drink while you're recharging all of your devices. But the main interactive attraction this weekend is something that they're calling Screen Burn Arcade. It's a huge exhibition room, and there's going to be a video game tournament held there. But it's one of the places that's actually open to the public, and it's free. And you go in, and there are just all of these new games and lights and music, and I saw a lot of kids and their parents walking around checking out, you know, all the latest in gaming technology. In fact, the first thing I saw was a few kids up on a small stage playing the popular video game Rock Band. And the whiz-bang electronic technology in the arcade, I mean, really was a magnet for a lot of people. But I have to tell you, they were also attracted to a giant Lego setup that had everything from the Taj Mahal and Yoda made out of Legos. So there were some low-tech attractions, too.
Yeah, Legos never get old. But it all fun and games?
No, actually, there's some very serious work going on here. Networking, first of all, a lot of exchange of business cards. But there's a lot of panels and small conferences, just a few titles, How Sci-Fi is Shaping the Internet. There's a panel on the iPad, New Opportunities for Content Creators. There's panels on citizen journalism. There's even one on Cooking for Geeks, which I'm not sure what that one's going to be. Friday, I was able to attend a session on how to fund gaming startups in a recession. And there were about 50 people in the room, and they were learning the do's and don'ts of raising money for their ventures from a gentleman who used to work for Dell, who's been very good at raising money. And he had a list of do's and don'ts. For example, do be confident. You're the expert, not the investor. And don't take every piece of advice because you can't absorb it all. And when the session ended, I met a woman named Susan Drescher, and her business card identified her as the president and chief herder of cats for a company called Extra Feet. She and her business partner have created a game called Evil.
Not too long ago, we were employed by MySpace, and we were released from MySpace when things started happening a year ago. And so we started a company of our own, and we just built a game.
They're trying to get the money to be able to launch it out. And then they said they have something else coming down the pipeline, but they wouldn't tell us. And the session where I met Susan Drescher was just one of some of 50 panels going on Friday. The interactive portion of the festival lasts 4 days. So, you know, do the math. 50 panels, 4 days. I mean, that's a lot of panels. And since it's impossible to go to each one, we tracked down Hugh Forrest, who's the event director for South by Southwest. And he gave us the big picture.
How did Austin and South by Southwest become the mecca for all of these pilgrims?
Well, as you know, South by Southwest was originally a music event, and it still is a very strong music event, and that's the base of what we do. I think that, or I know that, if there wasn't a music event to support what we did, we wouldn't have survived some of the very lean years. But in terms of why the event has grown and become a mecca, I mean, I think there are lots of different factors here. I mean, I think the geeks like being on the same stage as musicians, so to speak. And I say geeks in a totally loving way. I mean, the digital creatives who attend the event love to be on that same stage. And it's also very important that we have this big film event going on at the same time. I mean, again, the most meaningful connections that people make here are usually with someone completely outside of their industry that, wow, you mean you need a website and you make films and I need this film content and, you know, this is a great connection. And so, again, it's bringing these different people together and hopefully making these connections.
Do you mind if I just go through a random picking, a lucky dip of some of these panels? Okay. Cybersex 2.0. Is social networking ruining your sex life?
I got to say, that's one of the big questions or issues in this community is the more you tweet or the more you blog or the more you're transparent on the web, how does that impact your relationships, casual and more so?
What we learned watching kids with homemade flamethrowers.
That was a slam dunk in terms of accepting that. It's about tracking memes. One of the more popular memes, as we may or may not know, is people on YouTube with homemade flamethrowers. So the panel will be discussing that in specific, but trying to learn some more details on how these things go virally and why they go virally and what makes it spread and what doesn't make it spread.
And the other one, I mean, it seems like this is an issue that people are just beginning to think about. My Life Take Two. No, it's not. My Life Take Two, The Right to Delete.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Your Online Identity After Death and Digital Wills.
Sure.
Which goes along with, you know, deleting one's life.
Yeah, we did one session on that last year, and we create this virtual presence more and more with our new technologies. What happens to that presence when you pass away? Do you will that on to someone else to essentially keep on your virtual existence, or how does that work? And there are lots of services, or there's some services that help you with that process now. Now, the other session you mentioned was My Right to Delete, which is, again, in this brave new world we live in, the things we say or do often get onto the internet, and it's impossible to get rid of them. How do we move on if and when we want to move on?
Right. So how do you get the bad stuff off the web that your, you know, sister put up there from when you were a kid, you know?
Absolutely.
Hugh Forrest, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Audie, I mean, as you can see how difficult it would be to choose between, you know, cyber sex and Cooking for Geeks if they're going on at the same time. I actually heard somebody say that he wasn't going to bother to make up a schedule of things to go to. He preferred the Twitterverse to guide him. So he'd tweet and ask, where's the best place to go next? And I also can't talk about the festival without mentioning Twitter. I mean, everyone really is walking around with mobile devices, eyes down, fingers flying, and I'm surprised people aren't crashing into one another. Actually, while we were waiting in line to pick up our credential, there was a gentleman who actually made what we called a Twitter pitch.
So you guys on Twitter? We're trying to raise money for charity. And if we get 5,000 tweets with a hashtag in it, then we get $5,000 for charity by 5 p.m.
All right, Leanne, so what's next?
Well, we're hoping to catch up with some of the film people. There seem to be as many screenings as there are panels. We've actually done an interview already with a young man with a company that has a developing technology to make it easy to create video games. So we'll bring back that story. And by the way, we're meeting a lot of NPR fans here at South by Southwest. And they actually, a lot of them are listening on the new NPR iPhone app, which is, I suppose, not too surprising, given that everyone here is, as they say, digitally creative.
Leanne Hansen speaking to us from KUT in Austin, Texas. And you'll be back next week, right?
You betcha.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. There's one thing that's almost certain about getting a college degree nowadays. More than half of those who do will end up with debt, sometimes crippling debt. And with rising tuition rates and cutbacks, students across the country are screaming for help. Students from the University of California at Berkeley protesting a recent decision by the governing board to raise tuition by 32%. We begin the hour with a look at the skyrocketing costs of higher education and whether the government has any solutions. In a moment, we'll hear from Education Secretary Arne Duncan. He's hoping that next week, Congress will vote on a proposal to change the way the government offers student loans. First, though, to the University of the District of Columbia, where we stopped by this past week to talk with some students. UDC is by no means one of the most expensive universities in America, but the school recently decided to double its tuition fees for four-year students. And soon, it'll cost about $7,000 a year to attend. And that doesn't account for books or housing or other related costs.
My name is Tim. I'm 20 years old from Washington, D.C. I am paying for college with financial aid and loans. I will absolutely have debt at the end of college.
I'm Jessica Horniak. I'm 28, and I'm from West Virginia, but I'm living in D.C. I have a lot of debt because I've been in school for 7 years because I have 2 kids. And I'm only going to be graduating with an associate's degree.
Matthew Bradley, 27, from Ohio. Total combined debt, I just added it up the other day, it's approximately $90,000, and I'm not a doctor.
The voices of students from the University of the District of Columbia. Next week, Congress may take up the administration's education bill, and in it is a proposal to broaden the government's direct lending program. Right now, taxpayers subsidize a system where private, for-profit lenders like banks offer student loans that are backed by the government. The lenders make money off interest, and if the students default, well, the government picks up the tab. On Friday, I sat down with Education Secretary Arne Duncan, and he argues that that system is a waste of money, and he wants to cut out the middleman, in this case, private lenders.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever for us to continue to subsidize banks at a time when there's so much unmet need out there around the country.
You say this will save taxpayers money. But there is data, as you know, from several sources that says this plan will increase future deficits by billions of dollars.
This bill would not increase what taxpayers are on the hook for now. We have to educate our way to a better economy. That's the only way we get there. And by making a significant investment, again, tens of billions of dollars, Pell Grants, Perkins loans, tuition tax credits, so many great folks who have worked hard, who are committed to going to college. Maybe they're 18-year-olds graduating from high school. Maybe they're 38-year-olds and 58-year-olds who have been laid off and need to go back to school to be retrained and retooled. There's nothing more important we can do than invest in education. We can do this now, today, without going back to taxpayers for another dime.
The question is, why not just encourage universities to use the existing direct loan system instead of mandating it? Doesn't it open you up to accusations of a government takeover of the student lending industry?
Far from it. There's actually been two points. There's been a huge migration into direct lending as the private markets had dried up well before we got to Washington.
Yeah.
3 years ago, I think there were about 1,000 universities using direct lending. That's up about 2,300 now. And so that's happening anyway. The second point is we're just talking about who originates the loans, and we can do that. The servicing of the loans, which is where the action is, there should be no government involvement. This should be 100% private sector. It's not our skills. It's not our sweet spot. And what we want to do is let the private market play there, the free market. Great, good actors will get more business. Providers that don't do a good job of servicing loans will lose business. And so that will always stay in the private sector. The difference is we simply stop subsidizing banks at the front end on the origination of loans. This has been a sweet deal for banks.
How much money do you think this could save the federal government?
Literally tens of billions of dollars. And the first calculation by the CBO was $87 billion. There's a more recent calculation of about $67 billion. People said, why are you fighting this battle? And let me tell you, if this was $400, this is the right fight to fight.
For years, Americans were told that the best path to financial freedom was through homeownership. We now know that this may not be the case because of foreclosures. You have written that the best path to financial freedom is also through a university degree. I'm wondering if that is something we can say with certainty given the job market.
The job market is very, very tough, but I can say with certainty that there are no good jobs out there for high school dropouts. There are almost no good jobs out there for students with just a high school diploma. Every study will tell you that college graduates make significantly more money than non-college graduates.
But that doesn't take into account the current unemployment statistics. And I'm wondering if the only guarantee today from college, from having a college degree, is you will have debt. Is there an argument to be made that not everybody should go?
I think everyone should have some form of higher education. So again, whether it's four-year universities, two-year community colleges, trade, technical, vocational training, if all you have is a high school diploma, or if you don't even have that, your prospects are that much more limited.
As you know, over the past 2 decades, higher education costs have increased about 250%. The loans that are being made available have caps, and they don't necessarily match the rise in tuition.
Right. So we're trying to do everything we can do to help. Obviously, we share that concern about rising tuition costs. And what we want to do is continue to provide great amounts of information, transparency to students who are thinking about college. One of the the huge strengths of our country is we have this world-class educational system. We have literally thousands of schools of education, community colleges, and higher ed to pick from. And I think where you see escalating costs, people are very smart. They're going to vote with their feet, and they're going to go other places. And what you're actually seeing, while some universities continue to escalate costs at ridiculously high levels, you see others going to three-year programs. You see others going to no-frills campuses. And folks are going to continue to vote with their feet and go to places where they can get a great education at a reasonable price.
Let me ask you finally about that. There are more and more of these for-profit universities cropping up, the Kaplan's, the University of Phoenix's, and the number of students attending them, as you know, is on the rise. I mean, do you think these schools could create the kind of competition that would force traditional universities to lower their tuition?
We need more great options. Great for-profit actors can be part of the solution. You know, bad for-profit actors are part of the problem. Great traditional universities can be part of the solution. Traditional universities that are, you know, have way escalating costs, way more than the rate of inflation, are part of the challenge. So it's not really a question of for-profit versus non-for-profit. It's, are these schools doing a great job of educating students at a reasonable cost?
Arne Duncan is the Secretary of Education. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. The internet has taken a toll on print media, from newspapers and magazines to the telephone book. From member station WVTF, Sandy Houseman reports that university yearbooks are also taking a hit.
The University of Virginia is very big on tradition. Students here don't use the word campus because the school's founder, Thomas Jefferson, preferred the word grounds. And the most popular dorm rooms on grounds are tiny chambers built in 1820, heated only by a fireplace. Larry Sabato is a UVA professor and alum.
There are so many traditions that when you come in, half of the orientation period is learning what they are.
So it came as a shock when the university learned its student-run yearbook, which had published since 1888, could no longer cover its costs. In a survey of student leaders, fewer than half thought the yearbook should be saved, a view shared by senior Patrick O'Grady.
It's a shame to see it die, but I wouldn't have bought one anyway. I only know probably about 1% of our class.
Everything is so technological now that people just don't have a desire for a 400-page book that's going to sit on a shelf and collect dust.
Michelle Birch was last year's co-editor. She says the staff tried to generate interest, sending emails, handing out flyers, even putting ads on Facebook.
And when we realized that we couldn't even get people to come and take pictures, there's no way people are going to buy a book that they're not in.
At other universities, the story's much the same. Rich Stobey is with yearbook publisher Jostens. He says about 1,000 colleges still print a yearbook. That's down from about 2,400 in 1995. But Stobey doesn't blame the internet.
Virtually every high school and K through 12 school prints a yearbook of some type, even though online social networking has been around for a number of years.
Instead, he suggests the economy is a factor, with books costing up to $100 and students feeling less loyal to graduating classes that are bigger and more diverse than ever before. Whatever the reason, the decline of college yearbooks upsets many who love history. Whitney Spivey is a grad student at the University of Missouri, where the yearbook folded in 2006. She spent all four of her undergraduate years working on the yearbook at Virginia.
You know, every book is kind of like a little time capsule, and the hairstyles change and the fashion changes, and there are social movements, there are wars, there are, you know, at UVA, like, minorities and women were incorporated into university life, and you see this sort of progression of time and history, and I think it's just really interesting to look at.
And some are quite valuable because they contain an early poem by Edgar Allan Poe, drawings by William Faulkner, or a picture of the young Brad Pitt. There's even a company called eyearbook.com that's put thousands of old yearbooks online and charges people to search. So why not skip the publisher and put today's college yearbooks on a website in the first place? Kelly Furness advises the yearbook at Virginia Tech.
When we're interviewing students who are applying for editor of the yearbook, we actually ask them, in a world of MySpace and Facebook, why is a yearbook still relevant? And I think their answers are very telling. You know, first students say, who uses MySpace? And I think that's important, that no matter how popular an electronic service may be at this point in time, its existence can be somewhat fleeting.
And of course, you can't handwrite best wishes in the back of a website. For NPR News, I'm Sandy Houseman in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. As cars go, Yugoslavia's Yugo became a punchline, a car that people said doubled in value when you filled the gas tank. In short, it was declared barely roadworthy by Consumer Reports. But there was a time when Yugomania swept across America.
You're looking at the fastest-selling European import in its introductory year. You're looking at a car that costs $39.90. You're looking at a Yugo.
Between 1984 and 1992, Americans bought 150,000 Yugos. It was, far and away, the cheapest car on the market. Now, a quarter century after its launch in the U.S., the Yugo is being celebrated in a new book by Jason Buick. It's called The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. And as he explains in the book, the timing of the launch of the Yugo in America couldn't have been better. The man behind it was an entrepreneur named Malcolm Bricklin. And when he introduced the car to America, the country was in love with Yugoslavia. It was right after the 1984 LA Olympics when a Cold War dispute prompted the Warsaw Pact countries to boycott those games.
When all the other communist countries boycotted, China, Romania, and Yugoslavia did not. And Yugoslavia received the greatest ovation as they walked into the LA Coliseum at the opening ceremonies. Yugoslavia had left the Soviet orbit in 1948, and through the Cold War, we had supported Yugoslavia. You could enter and exit Yugoslavia freely. So there was a great deal of positive feeling towards the Yugoslavs.
So it was like a perfect storm, precisely the time to introduce a Yugoslav product.
It was precisely the time, too, because this is probably unknown to most American consumers. At this moment, both Detroit and the Japanese manufacturers had really vacated the very low end of the market. There were various reasons for this, but one was the Japanese were capturing a larger market share, and Detroit was pushing the Reagan administration for some sort of sanctions. The Japanese jumped in and said, wait a minute, we'll put a quota on ourselves. But what the Japanese did very smartly was instead of selling Spartan Civics or Tercels, they went upscale. And this leads, of course, to Acura, to Infiniti, to Lexus. So right when they left the market, the Yugo was the only game in town.
There was a vacuum at that point.
Huge vacuum that the Yugo filled at that very moment.
So before Bricklin brings the car to the U.S., he goes to their factory in Serbia. This is originally a munitions plant. They're now building cars. I guess it's an understatement to say they were taken aback when they arrived to this factory?
Yes. Several car men went with him, and they walked into this plant, and they couldn't believe it. The floors were unbelievably dirty. They actually had a machine with chains that would whip across the floor to take all the oil and scum off the floors. The first Yugos that they actually viewed, they found rust in the trunk. One of the men who went with Bricklin actually saw freshly painted fenders, if I remember, with dents on them.
Ready for the showroom.
Oh, ready to be assembled, to be sent out.
They were also surprised. You write about how the workers during their breaks would just take shots of Slivovitz, this plum brandy.
Oh, yes. They smoked while on the assembly line, while working in the cars. They were stepping on these dirty floors and stepping into the new cars. Just a lot of simple practices that they never observed, which meant that the Yugo never really was catastrophically bad. It just had a huge number of quality issues that added up to a bad car. They gave them a 4-meter fax, a list of over 400 changes that need to be done to the car. And they really did do it, to their credit. For how famous the Yugo is for being a bad car, these Yugo America men who went over there really did what I found to be a Herculean job of prepping this car for America.
Before we go on with this conversation, I understand that you have helped to bring us a working Yugo, which is waiting for us downstairs in front of the lobby here at NPR. There are, I think you write, there are fewer than 1,000 of them left on the road today. Shall we go?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, my gosh. It's a nice one. That's a nice car.
Wow, look at that beauty. So this was the car that Americans could buy for under $4,000.
Yes.
It doesn't look bad. I mean, it looks pretty good.
Yeah, it's just thin, you know, when you look at the parts and you look at the door handles and the things. But it was a $3,990 car. You know, people expected so much more, and that was part of the problem.
All right, well, let's meet the owner of the car. Arnold Campanelli is here with me. Arnold, thank you so much. Where are you from?
I'm from outside of Philadelphia.
So you drove this car down from outside Philadelphia?
Yes.
Did it break down on the way?
No.
No problems?
What year is this Yugo?
It's a 1991, and I purchased it brand new. I initially used it as a daily driver for a little while. Decided I'm going to put it away because that was the original intent. And hopefully someday, you know, someone would appreciate it down the road. And this is not my first Yugo. I've had about 8 or 9 of them.
You've had 8 or 9 Yugos.
I just love them.
Well, Arnold, you've agreed to drive us around in the Yugo for a little bit. So
sure.
Shall we go?
Yep.
Now, Arnold, before we get going, I got a cassette here. Can you pop that into the cassette player's side A here? We can't drive without some good tunes. All right, okay. We've got our Serbian version of Born to be Wild cranking. Arnold, let's go. Let's roll.
Okay.
All right, so now we're driving down Massachusetts Avenue here in Washington, D.C. A nifty little car, actually not bad. Handles pretty well, right?
Absolutely.
So Jason Buick, the subtitle of your book is The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History, but is there something redeeming about this car, about the Yugo?
Oh, absolutely. I really do not think that the Yugo was the worst car in history. The fact that it was sold here means it wasn't one of the worst cars in history. It passed safety tests and emissions tests, but for whatever reason, on Car Talk, on NPR's Car Talk, they actually voted, listeners voted the Yugo the worst car of the millennium.
Consumer Reports magazine really sunk the fortunes of this car in 1986, just a few months after it was officially launched in the U.S., basically recommending that people should buy a used car rather than a brand new Yugo. Was that sort of the beginning of the end for the car?
Oh, absolutely. When Consumer Reports pans a car, that's really the end for that car. It's a big deal. I actually interviewed the Consumer Reports person who tested the car, and he said that Yugo really wasn't that bad. It was just, for his buyers, wasn't of the best quality. But he said the engine was a tried-and-true Fiat engine that people had used for years and years in Europe and also in the United States. He just said it wasn't put together very well.
If you're just joining us, I am sitting inside of a Yugo with Jason Buick. He's the author of the new book, The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. Arnold Campanelli is the driver and owner of this Yugo, and he's very kindly agreed to drive us through the streets of Washington. And I should just mention, we're idling at a light right now, and a guy looks to be in his mid-60s, has just walked by across the street and given us the thumbs up. So clearly, Arnold, you're a popular guy when you drive this car. Do you get that a lot?
Yes, I do. I've actually been at stoplights where people roll down their windows and ask if it's for sale. And I told them, no, it's not. He's not at the moment.
Jason Buick, Yugo America basically called it quits in 1992. They went bankrupt. Obviously, that was due in part to a poor design and bad reviews. But there were other factors, too. I mean, 1989 happened. I mean, history really sort of begins to unfold. The Yugoslav wars begin. What happens?
Well, one of the problems was that Yugo America really brought over the same Yugo 5 or 6 years in a row, the same model car. And Americans expect new models every year. And then one problem was the sales were tanking, and then Yugoslavia started to fall apart. And the seats were made in Kosovo. The plastic came from Croatia. Other parts came from Slovenia and Serbia. And pretty soon, you couldn't put the car together, just like you couldn't put the country back together.
Well, I got to say, Arnold, I'm pretty impressed with this car. For $4,000, it handles pretty well, drives nicely. We just passed the White House. But I don't want to press our luck. So I think we ought to head back to NPR.
Okay.
All right. Man, that was a wild ride.
That was fun.
Jason Buick and Arnold Campanelli, thank you so much for coming by and talking to us about the book, Jason.
Yes, thank you.
And Arnold for driving down here and letting us take a ride in your car.
Very welcome.
Jason Buick is the author of The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. And Arnold Campanelli is the owner of one of the last Yugos on the road today in the United States.
You know there's one thing that I'm wondering, and you'd wonder why, and that is who will drive my
On radio stations in Boston, on Catholic TV, and on the web, the Archdiocese of Boston is trying to bring Catholics back to confession.
If you're looking to deepen your faith during the season of Lent, the priests of the Boston Archdiocese welcome you to join them in celebrating the Sacrament of Reconciliation. Visit any church.
The Light is On For You is the name of the campaign, and one of its spokespeople is Father Robert Reed, director of Catholic TV. He joins us now. Good morning, Father Reed.
Good morning, Audie. Nice to be with you.
Now, something like 75% of American Catholics don't go to confession at all. What are some of the reasons that the church is seeing that?
Well, I think that some of the reasons would be a lack of understanding of the sacrament, perhaps some anger or animosity toward the church, a bad experience in the past, or maybe just being out of practice, and I think that's why this campaign is an important thing to do in a diocese.
The website, thelightisonforyou.org, has a video on how to go to confession.
Step one, examine your actions since your last confession. Reflect on those that have hurt other people or distanced you from God.
I mean, is this something that Catholics really need to be educated about? I mean, the actual step-by-step process?
I think it is, because that perhaps is one of the reasons why people don't approach the sacrament as much anymore, because they're afraid of perhaps they are going to do it wrong, and so it really is very simple. In fact, a lot of the burden is on the priest, and we do try to help people through it.
You talked about trust in the church, and I'm wondering how you think that the sexual abuse crisis that affected the Catholic Church has affected people's willingness to go and to be part of the community and to go to confession.
I'm absolutely certain it's a factor. And so I think that's why, you know, the campaign is important, not just this Lent, but in the coming years, to let people know that there's a lot of really great guys, my brother priests, who are out there, and they themselves know that, you know, they're sinners. I know I'm a sinner. I avail myself of the sacrament, and I want to invite people to come and to have this face-to-face encounter, not as much with me and with my brother priest, but with Jesus Christ himself, and be reconciled. We all need that, and we want to invite people and let people know that we are there for them.
So is it a part of rebuilding trust with the community?
Absolutely. And I know that's very much needed. It's been such a difficult period and continues to be for Catholics who are estranged from the church, for us as priests, and it's a burden that we all carry. And it's going to take many, many years, perhaps decades, to recover from this and to continue to invite people back to the Lord and to the community, which is the church.
Father Robert Reed is the director of Catholic TV. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
I appreciate the chance to do that. Have a wonderful Sunday.
This is NPR News.